From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The number of kids being arrested in the state of Florida is on a downward trend, which is good news in most places, but not in Orange County, and particularly not if you're black. According to juvenile justice records, the county leads the state, and black kids make up 64% of the arrests under 18 years of age. Reporter Renato Sago spent 4 months trying to find out why. Her reporting tells the story of teenage boys navigating the juvenile justice system and follows them back to where they grew up, in neighborhoods where crime is a way of life. We'll talk with Renata Sago about her series of reports. Plus, an ongoing economic recovery, gains in healthcare and retail jobs, and continued low wages. Those are the findings from last year's study of Southwest Florida's workforce. We'll break down the numbers with the economists behind the study and find out what it means for workers and employers in our region. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Southwest Florida filled more empty nursing jobs last year and saw jobs in construction grow by 13%. But wages in our region continue to lag behind the state and national average, and more high-demand specialty jobs in healthcare remain unfilled. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll talk with an economist looking at the latest workforce report for our area and how job watchers are emphasizing education to grow Southwest Florida's economy beyond retirement and tourism. But first, Young and Arrested. That's the title of a series of reports from WMFE reporter Renata Sago. In it, she looks at the juvenile justice system in the Florida county that leads in kids' arrests, Orange County, where more than 1,000 kids were arrested last year, 64% of whom were black. This is a county in which 22% of the population is black. Renata Sago, thanks for being on the show to share your research and stories with us.
For having me.
We're talking with Renata Sago about her reporting on juvenile arrests and racial disparity in Orange County, Florida. You can become part of the conversation, too, by calling us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Renata, overall, the state of Florida's juvenile arrest numbers are on the decline, but what made Orange County such an outlier?
You know, that's a great question. Here in Orange County, it has to do a lot with recidivism. So again, in Orange County, you have an overall 40-decade low, which is representative of what's taking place across Florida. But you have some very challenged youth who are dealing with situations that a lot of us might not conceive of, and they are being arrested for crimes that are more severe. They're being arrested for felonies, and they're being arrested multiple times. So it's really recidivism that's driving those numbers up here.
Well, what made you want to look into it a little bit further to try to find the cause?
Well, to be honest, I went to a press conference back in November 2016. It was about civil citations, this push to give kids who've committed a crime for the first time a sort of ticket that basically gives them a chance and doesn't leave them with a record. But also, I realized, hey, this is more than a 40-second type of story. This is something that needs to be done a bit more in depth. And also, total disclosure, my father was incarcerated for about 15 years of my own young adult life. And so you see in a lot of these troubled communities sort of patterns of young black men being arrested. And the numbers here in Orange County reflect that same national rate.
So you worked on this compilation of stories for 4 months?
4 months. Yes, I got digging shortly after that press conference in November and pretty much started looking at the numbers, spoke with a lot of law enforcement officers who were really encouraged by their push to enforce those civil citations, the small tickets, but also a bit disenchanted with the reality that they can't issue these civil citations to young kids who have committed felony offenses. They just don't apply to them. And they've said that the crimes have grown more severe. So I wanted to dig into who exactly were the kids committing those crimes.
Well, let's have a listen to the piece that you did that focused on the Pine Hills neighborhood and the story of Jalen Cobb.
Jill Wells points to a room with a window counter, a makeshift photo booth, and a scanner. Just feet away, a girl sits slumped over in a navy blue jumpsuit, and a boy looks up at a television.
This is what we call booking.
Wells is the chief probation officer for Orange and Osceola counties.
They come over here, and they get their picture made and their fingerprints done. So everybody is booked into the system.
She oversees operations here at the Orange County Juvenile Assessment Center, known as the JAC. It's where youth are taken by the police when they've been stopped. It's an inconspicuous building in Paramore, right across from the Orange County Health Department and within walking distance of the new soccer stadium. Inside is a world of its own with intake staff, probation officers, representatives from Orange County Public Schools, and private community service providers.
The staff here logs in the youth and looks through their paperwork, makes sure we have everything from the officer before we let the officer leave the facility.
Wells remembers this area used to be a hub for juvenile arrest problems.
Now it's spread out so much. You know, we go to Bithlow to Ocoee, and we have kids from every direction. It's not just Paramore or not just Pine Hills.
Here is determined where kids go, to the juvenile detention facility or home. But first, staff screens the kids.
They're trying to gather information on their school, their mental health, their substance abuse, if they've been involved in gang activity.
That data is sent to a juvenile judge with recommendations and a score.
And based on that score, the judge knows what their risk factor is.
Look at this. This is how you know you is in the wrong part of the neighborhood when your payphones ain't got no phone. Ain't got a cord to the phone. don't run into this. You need help, boy. You better run right past that.
Jalen Cobb had already been labeled high risk by the time he came to the Jack. He grew up on 10th Street in Apopka.
And that's one of the hardest streets to grow up on this side of town. You could just be sitting outside and people just start shooting.
He's got an infectious laugh and a way of making light of things. At 20 years old, he's seen more tough situations than most adults have seen in all their lives.
These apartments right here, everybody came here bought their dope. Crackheads. Miss Sybil used to have that orange house right there. She got robbed, man, and they killed her, man.
He's got plenty more stories like these to tell. And for Cobb, whose mom had him at 15 and whose dad has been in prison since he can remember, the notion of family and opportunities is counter to the norm in a major segment of Orange County, let alone the United States.
My father's a drug dealer. My uncles are drug dealers. My grandma used to sell drugs. My mama, she talked to nothing but drug dealers. That's all I really knew for a point in my life. You know what I'm saying? If I hang around a thief, sooner or later, I'm going to pick up some tendencies.
He had to come into manhood early, or as much as he could understand of it as a child. By the time he was 13, he was in a gang. He dropped out of school and got his first charge for robbing a Walgreens with a gun on him.
They sent me to a program for 18 months for that.
That program was the Charles Britt Academy in Pinellas County. It's one of more than 50 centers for kids considered likely to get back in trouble. It's an all-male facility with 28 beds and a full-service staff.
All of the providers are private providers, so there's no single state-owned, state-run residential program.
Carter Hay is a criminologist at Florida State University. In the past two decades, he's seen the state relinquish its direct control of residential facilities to private companies that provide services outlined in contracts with the state. Those services include security, food, medical care, and programs. Hay says that has to do with dollars and cents.
On the question of whether we want to altruistically save juvenile delinquents, well, that tends to bring up some political divisions where people don't always agree. But when it comes to the question of cost effectiveness, everyone wants to do that.
Though in recent years, concerns about the quality of services has led the state to canceling contracts. That's a concern for Catherine Pizzoni, who has the Juvenile Defense Clinic at Barry University School of Law. She's represented Jalen Cobb and other kids sent to residential facilities for 8 years.
They're so understaffed compared to the number of kids they have and the complexity of the problems that a lot of times it just seems like glorified babysitting to me. And the kids aren't getting any real help. And then they put them right back in the same neighborhood and I see them on the intake docket again. And I want to go bang my head against a wall.
That's what happened to Cobb. When he returned to Apopka, he ended up with a series of charges.
The kids who are breaking into houses and stealing cars, they're not just bad kids. It's a lot more complicated than that. And the more I learn about it, the more I think, you know, we're kind of putting the judgments of middle-class white people on kids who are living in a society that most of us can't even imagine.
Current private providers maintain that they're fulfilling their contractual obligations to the state. But Pozzoni would like to see the state offer incentives to private companies, ones based on kids getting their diplomas and holding steady employment and feeding resources into neighborhoods where kids are coming from. Places like 10th Street in Apopka, where Jalen Cobb grew up.
Most people don't make it. It sucks you back in, especially if you're doing good. You don't ever want to stay in Apopka too long, especially if you've been doing good. I spent all of my juvenile years in jail, locked up, all that. Now, I'm not trying to be a statistic.
Cobb got a break on charges with help from Pozzoni. He's earned his GED, he's trained at the Cordon Bleu, and now he's a team supervisor at McDonald's. But his real dream is to own a food truck.
If I feel in the mood, I can make a bomb burger. Stuffed burgers, vegan burgers, and I can make a good burger. I make it some steak, potatoes with shrimp.
Life for him is good because, well, he's living, and he knows there's more to life.
I met a lot of people who did less than me, got direct filed.
He's referring to kids who went straight to adult court.
I had people backing me, you know what I'm saying? You got to give people some type of chance. Everybody that's a felon, not a felon by choice. Some people's in a situation where they couldn't help it, you know what I'm saying? I was.
For Cobb, his saving grace before the storm would have been resources. Someone there to help him before he slipped.
So, Renata, have you been able to keep up with Jalen since doing the story at all?
I have been able to keep up with Jalen. And to even get in contact with Jalen was very difficult because he didn't have a functioning phone. So we were on Facebook Messenger. And, you know, a few times I met up with him in Apopka and he wasn't there. So he's sort of hard to catch. But since then, he has actually got a supervisor position at the Gap. So he's really trying to work his way through.
Well, that's good. So one of the things that he talks about is how the neighborhood he grew up in sort of formed his expectations for his future. And one of the statements in that piece that really sticks out is that people are judging these kids based on white middle class judgments of kids growing up in a world that they have no concept of. This disconnect, do you think that's part of why the juvenile justice system right now fails these kids once they end up there?
To be honest, yes. And, you know, it's something that I've heard from people within the system. And I'm not talking about kids who ended up incarcerated. I'm talking about actual judges. I spoke with a juvenile judge who's worked in the system since before it was called the Department of Juvenile Justice. I'm talking before the early 90s. And he was completely disillusioned with the reality that you get a lot of lawmakers who have very, what he called, emotional reactions to things that are happening. And then they file legislation without fully thinking about the consequences. He said that lawmakers are simply disconnected. So that's what's going on.
I mean, the disconnect is so vast. I mean, I'm going to put a finer point on just how different the goals and expectations are for these children. I want to hear from one of the young men that you interviewed. Here's Angel Sanchez comparing two very starkly different norms.
Going to college seems like the thing to do. If your family went to college, and even if they didn't, if they have a good understanding of it, and if you're surrounded in a neighborhood with everyone is preparing to go to college and you have teachers preparing you for that. So not going to college seems to be the hard thing to do, right? While in another segment of America, graduating high school seems to be the hard thing to do. Dropping out seems to be normal. Getting a 9-to-5 job, minimum wage, selling drugs, robbing, stealing, those seem the things that seem to be normal. As an adult looking at them, we know that they're very young and immature and really have a lot of odds stacked against them. But teenagers don't see that.
So, Renata, in a neighborhood like Pine Hill, what's the pressure like for someone to fall in with that kind of a status quo? I mean, how would a person be viewed if they're going to high school and applying for colleges? Is that ever something that's celebrated?
My goodness, it's about respect. You know, at the end of the day, everybody wants respect. But in communities like these, where, as Angel said, you know, the norm is minimum wage, the norm is gangs, that's how you get respect. If you're going to college, you're what they call a lame. You know, what are you doing? You think you're better than us?
And then that creates a sort of ideology where you become a target for thinking that you're better, for blazing a trail that has been perceived as, you know, not the cool thing to do or not the easy thing to do. It's very tough.
I think it would be kind of hard to swim against that stream. We are talking with reporter Renata Sego, who recently completed a report called Young and Arrested, which shines a light on the circumstances behind the statistics in Orange County, where, according to juvenile justice records, black kids are arrested much more frequently than any other race, making up 64% of the already high 6,500 kids arrested last year there, the most in any county of the state. Give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Renata, I took a look at the data for Southwest Florida, which is where we are, and we cover several counties here. Overall, in juvenile arrests, whites made up a greater percentage than blacks or Hispanics. However, the percentages were not really in line with the overall population breakdown. For example, just in Lee County, where Fort Myers is, 49% of kids arrested were white, 28% were black, and 22% Hispanic. But the census data breaks the race down in this county by 87% white, 9% black, and 19% Hispanic. In your reporting, did you see this pretty consistently?
Disproportionate. Yes, that is consistent across the board. And that's what a lot of civil rights advocates are concerned about. They call it disparate treatment of youth of color. And something that Angel Sanchez brought up actually is data that he feels as a civil rights advocate that the numbers are much higher for Latinos, because you get a lot of Latinos who are arrested and then they're filed as white in the system. So that's another thing to think about.
Yeah, we talked earlier about recidivism, and, you know, there's been talk about civil citations, and we've done a show on it here before, too. The civil citations are only for first-time offenders, or usually, almost always, and they give them community service and treatment options instead of arrest. And you're saying that that hasn't made much of an impact because the kids they're dealing with now have already been arrested. Usually, right?
Right, right. The civil citation program, a lot of folks within the system, they're behind it. They believe that it's a great preventive approach, and that when we're looking 10, 20 years down the line, that may help a portion of kids. But the reality is that these communities have to undergo some sort of change. There's got to be some structural changes so that kids who are stopped don't find themselves committing much larger, more severe crimes just out of sheer need, you know, for access.
So the hope is that future first-time offenders can then be deterred from going forward and continuing.
That's the hope. But again, a lot of people I've spoken with are really adamant about saying, hey, let's go in and let's really look at the source of the problem, which really is the family, it's the schools, it's the sort of structural community-wide issues. Well, law enforcement, you know, civil citations, that's a law enforcement approach.
Yeah.
But then it's a community-wide thing that needs to happen, too.
Well, another sidebar to recidivism is that a juvenile going back into the justice system over and over again, that can cause them to find themselves, you know, just continuing to perpetuate things. I mean, psychologically, how does that impact them?
You know, that's something that I spoke with a former public defender about, the psychological implications. It's so deep, and it's something that can span generations. To be labeled a problem. Can you imagine being labeled a problem at an early age and then being punished for that? It's almost the idea of, hey, kids are blank slates. They don't know what they don't know. How are they expected to be taught a different way if they don't have the exposure or to know that there's a different way? So you get a lot of kids who they enter the system at 14, get out at maybe 26, and they're 14. You know,
yeah, they're kind of stuck at 14.
Yeah, developmentally or just, you know, but there's a lot of things at play, too, because I met a lot of young men who felt like they found a sense of guidance within the juvenile justice system, whether it was through nonprofit programs or for one young man, it was in prison that he found big brothers and cousins who really guided him. But mind you, these sorts of programs, all this guidance is happening within a construct, within a prison.
Yeah. Let's hear from Leroy Purnell, who you mentioned a minute ago. He's a professor of law at Florida A&M University and former public defender, about how being called a problem child can really have a deep impact.
It is psychologically stressful to the point of being in need of serious treatment to sometimes be a black youth who's been labeled a problem. And if you're told you're a problem long enough and you start to believe that you're a problem long enough, you're going to need some serious psychological help to get past that. We don't really plan for that anymore. Systems don't seem to know how to deal with that.
So, Renata, you spent a lot of time talking with authorities for this story, as well as the kids that are involved. Do you see the system moving towards any kind of understanding or any type of psychological help for these kids?
Psychological help.
Not just retraining, but I mean, like he mentioned, like Mr. Purnell was saying, I mean, I just can't imagine how scary it would be for a kid to just go to jail.
Yeah. Well, that's tough. You know, I'm seeing more engagement between law enforcement and the community in terms of resources available outside of the community. Gotta say that there is a shortage of those sorts of resources for kids to be able to have access to the psychological support that they need. But hey, Florida, the Department of Children and Families, they're working with the Department of Juvenile Justice. There's a lot of grant funding to make sure that we are now able to create that infrastructure. But the reality also is that the law doesn't necessarily say, hey, this kid broke into this person's house, or this person broke into a store to get some food because maybe they've been denied food at their home. It just says, hey, this kid has a crime. So the law is sort of looking at these kids as criminals as opposed to maybe larger issues.
What kind of programs have you seen working?
Oh, wow. There are quite a few and they don't get enough attention. For example, there's one in Orlando's Pine Hills neighborhood, which has the highest number of highest volume of arrests in the state. It's called Man Up. And so they take a lot of these kids in the community. They take them to, for example, the Kennedy Space Center. They take them and do vision board parties. They have discussions about sex and, you know, protection and what it means to be a man. It's just an awesome program that's received a lot of support from the community. Also, there are a lot of Boys and Girls Club that are doing some important work. There are a lot of activist groups that are empowering kids within the community, too. And also young men and women who have exited the system and are in desperate need of reentry support. It's called Let Your Voice Be Heard, which is making waves. So there's hope.
That's good. Hey, it sounds so such a downer, but I mean, even the numbers total are down. Even in Orange County, they're still high, but they're down from last year. So it's going the right direction.
Right.
Can you tell me the story about Marquis McKenzie?
Yeah, Marquis McKenzie is the young man who was interviewed in my first story. He was sent to prison at age 16 for an armed burglary. It was over a wallet and a pager. And right now he's 26. He got out of prison early, got off probation early for good behavior, started at community college. That didn't work out too well for him, but he did start a business, a cleaning business called the Dirt Master. And just actually 2 days into my series, I learned that Marquis McKenzie had been arrested again, basically for trespassing. And since then, I've learned that those charges have been dropped. So again, recidivism, a lot of people, once they enter the system, they do not return. But then you get people who do. And for Marquis, he said that he's felt that there's also been a stigma attached to his history and that officers are more inclined to arrest him and pursue charges because they see he went to prison.
Yeah, they look up your record as soon as they stop you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So a juvenile judge that you interviewed named Daniel Dawson, it seemed that once kids who are in the system realize that they're really in trouble, their demeanor kind of changes. Here are his comments.
The biggest concern I have about the system is that, you know, most of the time the individual that committed the crime isn't the same individual when you get to the end of the cycle. And I have gone to adult jail and talked to kids who've been charged as an adult. I've talked to kids who were pending their adult trials. I've talked to them. They've already been sentenced. And there's a lot of consistency in where those kids come from, how they were brought up, when they started going bad, if you want to call it that, and their views now that they've been sitting in the Orange County Jail for a while. And you can tell they're not the same kids that you would go and interview at the detention center. They have changed.
Renata, did you ever talk with any kids who ended up getting scared straight, as it were?
I talked to grown men who had, yes.
Yeah.
and yeah, I mean, they've either gone into roles where they are now law enforcement or working as attorneys, and some of them have gone off. I remember speaking to one gentleman who had gone off to pursue a master's degree in accounting. Some people, they get, you know, they realize the changes that they've made, and they have the support system once they get out in order to sort of be guided and continue to be guided in that direction. And other people just don't.
It's just hard, though, to try to tell a younger kid who hasn't been there and been scared that that could happen to them. It seems like they all kind of think they can get by with it, or they're tough enough to handle it.
That's a good question. And a few people within the system, for example, there's a gentleman who handles teen court for the Ninth Circuit. And that's pretty much where teens, they represent each other. They are part of the jury. You know, they determine what sort of sentences that they'll have for each other. He said that the scared straight programs where they take a kid into a prison, those are proven to actually traumatize the kids.
Yeah.
And so now the Department of Juvenile Justice is really trying to assess, hey, how much intervention do we actually need for this certain kid for this certain offense? And they're really trying to get data driven to understand.
Is there a fear of being charged as an adult that can keep kids somewhat in line?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of these kids, based on my interviews, they don't think that they're going to be tried as an adult.
And they're kind of fearless. Well, some of the people that you interviewed seemed really motivated to try to help these kids, albeit frustrated with the system. Here's Kathy Puzone, who is an associate professor of law at Barry University and who oversees the Juvenile Defense Clinic.
You realize how smart they are, how creative they are. One of these kids we're throwing away maybe could cure cancer. Or they could just be the teacher who makes a difference in another kid's life. If I hear that phrase, pull yourself up by your bootstraps one more time, when you put kids in this system, you're taking away their shoes.
So, Renata, did you encounter a lot of people like Kathy who seem really invested in trying to make a difference? Or is there an overall sense of resignation that this is just how it is?
My goodness, I have not met more passionate people over a four-month period of reporting than in the juvenile justice system. I'm talking judges, state attorneys, people like Pozzoni. They're all passionate, but the reality is they all have different views about how kids need to be handled. And I think that's where the rift comes. But we're seeing more collaboration. We're seeing more collaboration between state agencies and between the community and nonprofits.
Well, it seems like you have a bunch of people that really want to do the same thing and have the same goals in mind, but just different ideas of how to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So they're all coming to the table at this point, and then what is there to stop them? I guess getting it up to the legislature and trying to make some changes?
Yes, the legislature. You know, that seems to come up often. You have the actors, you have the judges who are pretty much applying the law, interpreting the law. You have law enforcement, which is enforcing the law. And then you have the people within the community who are subject to the law. And they all point their fingers all point to Tallahassee. And it's the folks there who they feel have the biggest opportunity to implement change.
Do you think as a result of some of this kind of reporting that you're doing that might be able to inspire these groups to maybe get together to be able to lobby effectively?
Yeah, by all means. I've had a few people come up to me or send emails saying that they, either heard about the series or listened to the series and it sparked an idea in their mind. You know, just very recently, I received a letter from someone, a committee within Orlando City Council, basically encouraging the city council to consider funding more community centers so that kids in sort of challenged communities can have access to some safe and healthy fun. And, you know, Joe Negron, he's been really adamant about pushing for civil citations. I think the more exposure, the more conversations we have about this, whether people are agreeing or not, that's really helpful to inciting change.
I think just making people aware of the society and situation that these kids are growing up in at least helps put a frame of reference around that instead of simply a statistic.
Definitely.
So this is the kind of reporting that a reporter likes to do when you actually see some things happen.
Yeah, and it humanizes statistics, right? I mean, so often we hear 50% of blah, 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 64% of blah, blah, blah. We don't see the faces behind these numbers. And when you humanize an issue, when you are allowed to basically connect and show the sort of challenges or the triumphs in a person's life, I think that also has the ability to touch people.
Yeah, because in the end, we're all people. We're not all
right.
Numbers necessarily.
Right, right.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. I want to thank our guest, Renata Sago, for joining us and talking about your magnificent reporting on young and arrested. Very interesting stories, and thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we break down the numbers of Florida's latest workforce study, looking at why job numbers are good, but wages continue to lag behind the rest of the country. This is Gulf Coast Live.